Good afternoon and welcome to the only show you need to get you through your Tuesday, to get you through another crazy, wild, maddening day of news that we're going to figure out together live on the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH, streaming live on the KTTH smartphone app. We got a lot to get to. We only have 2 hours left to do it. In any normal world, in any reasonable world, Democrats would be upset with censorship on Twitter, especially censorship against a politician, especially if an opposition party was involved in making the demands. And yet we do not live in that world. And that is what's trending, brought to you by Guardian Roofing and Gutters.
What's trending? The Biden administration.
You see, when it comes to hanging on to power or getting power, when it comes to ousting the other side, when it comes to being able to demonize the other side, when it comes to defeating Trump, Democrats throw out all of their morals, their values, their principles. Trump broke them. Trump broke them. Now, I truly believe that some folks on the left believe that Trump is a danger and democracy's on the line. It's not a rational belief, but I believe that they believe it. There are others who are just acting out in bad faith. They have nefarious intent. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because what they're okay with, what they put up with, is wrong, regardless of the reasons behind why they put up with it. It's as disgusting as it is alarming. The Twitter story and the Twitter files, which, by the way, we just got an update about 45 minutes ago, and we'll get to it in a second. But the story about the censorship on Twitter and the political pressure being put on Twitter by Democrats, the party, by a campaign that maybe some Twitter employees thought was going to be successful, and oh my gosh, they better get in line right now, because if Biden wins, we don't want to be on his enemies list. In any world, this is a huge story. And yet, for the most part, it's being ignored. It's being ignored by the networks, and it's being disingenuously reported on by the folks over at CNN and MSNBC and in the New York Times. They don't seem to think it's that big of a deal. I think reasonable people can understand why this is, in fact, a big deal. And why, if you wanted to be as mild in your criticism, you would at least call it problematic, which is a word that folks on the left love to use. Democrats said nothing and they knew about it. In fact, they were behind a lot of it. But there was one Democrat who's become an unlikely hero in all of this, someone who's very, very, very progressive, of whom he and I and conservatives and he will have almost nothing in common. But when it comes to this issue of free speech and censorship, Ro Khanna is on the right side. And he was the only person that at least we have access to so far that we know of that reached out personally to Twitter executives, and say, what are you doing here? Whoa, 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 slow your roll. We don't do this. Why would you censor a New York Post story? And by the way, this is coming from someone, a criticism of Twitter that's coming from someone who wanted Joe Biden to win. He was no fan. He's no fan of Trump. And maybe somewhat ironically, or maybe this is part of the reason why he got involved, this is the dude who represents Silicon Valley. And so maybe he understands the threat of censorship against technology companies that he represents. Or maybe he understands the power that big tech has, and putting those two things together is just not a good mix. But he was someone who became a hero in all of this. And he was on CNN this morning. And he actually discussed and defended what his position was at the time and what his position is right now. There's no difference. It was wrong.
Liberal Democrats should be for the principle of standing up for First Amendment speech. And New York Times Sullivan said, we want speech to be open, uninhibited, wide-ranging. Now, I get Twitter's a private actor, but they're effectively a modern public square. And it was disappointing to me that they were suppressing the New York Post.
It was more than disappointing, though. Because he's one of those folks who was wondering why other colleagues of his, of other Democrats, didn't step up. Now, again, in fairness, is it possible, because we haven't seen all of the Twitter files yet, and we're supposed to get another dump of files this week or weekend, is it possible that some others, either emailed or made phone calls? Sure, I guess. None have spoken out. They didn't speak out at the time, and they didn't speak out when the Twitter files came out to say, like, hey, by the way, I was also involved. I also thought it was wrong. Ro Khanna, to his credit, at the time, I recall, I don't know how much he did it, but I recall at the time he at least said it was wrong. And on CNN today, he said, yeah, look, folks in my own party should be speaking up.
This was about a journalist at the New York Post writing an article about the situation. And there's no justification for suppressing that. Even if the source of that had gotten that information through something that was hacked, that was the case of the Pentagon Papers. Journalists should be allowed to publish things as long as they aren't participating in
it. Hey, journalists, by the way, who don't take this story seriously, you remember that part? You remember that whole story and the Pentagon Papers? Because I know that this is one of those stories that it lives on forever in what is important to journalism, what's being taught and lauded in journalism school, in communication courses. And in this case, because, and giving them the benefit of the doubt, even though no one truly believed that it was hacked, that was nonsense and everyone knew it at the time. But even just giving someone that impression, they'll just say, they believe truly that it was hacked material. That doesn't mean it's false, and it doesn't mean it's not newsworthy. And they still made the decision not only not to cover it, and in many ways, depending on the person, certainly the networks, CNN and MSNBC, actively dismissed it as not a story, that it was Russian disinformation. No one even tried to fact check the folks who claimed it was hacked or the folks who claimed this has the markings of Russian disinformation. If someone tells you that, and you're a journalist, not an analyst, not a talking head necessarily, although I would do, if that was given to me, I would do my best to try to fact check as best as I can. But if you're a news person, a journalist who's a supposedly down the middle, nonpartisan, as objective as humanly possible reporter, wouldn't you fact check it? Wouldn't you say, hey, but before we go, let me just, he's probably not even going to respond, but why don't we ask Hunter Biden if this is his laptop? Do you remember anyone asking whether or not it was his laptop? You know when they asked it? When he published a book acknowledging that it was his laptop. And it was the 60 Minutes interview. I think it might have been Anderson Cooper. I can't remember. But no one at the time was saying, hey, Hunter, did you in fact leave a laptop at a Delaware computer shop? And was like, oh, it couldn't be true. It's totally fake. He knew, by the way, the entire time. He didn't say anything. His father goes during a debate with Donald Trump. His father goes on TV and says, this is total nonsense. Look at all the experts. They're telling you the truth. This is fake. It's Russian disinformation, man. It's a bunch of malarkey. Did Hunter not tell, hey big guy, it's probably true. And just as an FYI, you're going to see some photos and videos on that laptop that I desperately don't want you or mom to see. So just put on your family-friendly filters online or have one of the interns do it. Oh, on those big phones with the track phones you don't get. Okay, never mind. You don't get the internet on your phone. It's a flip phone still. Got it. Perfect. Thank you. But Ro Khanna is right. He's right. And we can pretend he's not all we want because, or Democrats can pretend because he makes them look bad. But I'm glad that he's speaking up.
And I do hope more Democrats will stand up for the broader principle, which is we want to be have forums that don't have censorship, that allow for all perspectives.
There's nothing unfair or unreasonable about that position. Nothing controversial. Now, I said we have an update on the Twitter files. There were some folks who were wondering why they didn't get an update over the weekend. And I vaguely recalled some claims that more files were to come. Well, according to Matt Taibbi, and now another reporter, Barry Weiss, formerly of the New York Times, now she's Substack writer. She's also, by the way, a liberal, like Matt Taibbi, but she's like a reasonable one. They said former Deputy General Counsel Jim Baker, who was, I say former, he was working with Twitter. And unbeknownst to Elon Musk and management, he was vetting and slowing down the release of the Twitter files. Elon Musk found out about this over the weekend and he was fired. That, according to Matt Taibbi. He published some internal communications, and he was able to get this information out there. In fact, Elon Musk tweeted after Matt Taibbi said, yeah, the reason why this was getting slowed down was because of Jim Baker. So Elon Musk tweeted, and this just happened, in light of concerns about Baker's possible role in suppression of information important to the public dialogue, he was exited from Twitter today. So he just, I like this Elon Musk. He's probably very reckless and spends like a crazy person, but at least on this issue, I'm down with his style. It's like, yeah, you're not doing this. Sorry, you work for me. I don't work for you. And if you have any legitimate concerns about the release of the Twitter files as a lawyer that you want me to know about, fine, tell me. But he did this privately, according to Matt Taibbi. It's kind of nutty to me. It's absolutely nutty. Now, one of the tweets that was sent in this long string from Matt Taibbi was, and I quoted this yesterday, was Brandon Borman saying, can we truthfully claim that this is part of the policy in justification of getting rid of or banning the link? That's when Jim Baker responded by saying, caution is warranted. And so the suspicion is he's slowing all of this down because he's one of the defenders of taking the content down or banning it from Twitter. And presumably, at least by implication, he's someone who doesn't want to be outed as being responsible or at least partly responsible. So kudos to Elon Musk for making what at least seems like the right move. Is there any other update? The new update is the new update to the update is we might get something either by the end of the week or this weekend. I hope it's during, well, I hope it comes at 6 o'clock on Thursday so I have time to read it and then I can do it live the next day, because last week when they did it and it was not easy to cover, and at some point I said, I can't do this live. It's not going to work. I'll do it on Monday. So hopefully we won't have to go through that again. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
Seattle Times rewrote one of my editorials as their own, which on the one hand, I'm flattered because you recognize that I'm right and you're sharing an important position. But on the other hand, I'm like, I did it better, so you should just read my story. But it is curious to see that some media outlets are now talking about the story we talked about a week and a half ago, which was the Seattle Police Department was just permanently defunded of 80 positions by the Seattle City Council. There's some outlets that want to pretend that this is not that big of a deal. And whether they're doing it intentionally or they just don't know the story details, I've heard some outlets or some media folks say, well, I mean, they weren't going to hire 200 cops anyway. And so what they decided to do was just not fund 80 of those positions, but fully fund 120 positions, which, by the way, they're probably not going to be able to fill anyway. That part's true. The difference is they permanently defunded 80 police positions in a department that's already understaffed. In other words, they shrunk the size of a department permanently. There will have to be another piece of budget legislation or something that brings the funding back versus just temporarily cutting the funds because they knew they weren't going to be able to use them, and then reallocating them just for this budgetary year. They chose to permanently defund, and we're supposed to pretend that they didn't. That's what we're supposed to pretend. Oh, no, it makes total sense. And again, the people who are telling you that, and I've seen some folks like on Twitter, I think Como did a piece that was not the best in the world. I don't know if they're keeping out the permanence part of it because they simply don't know, or they're being dishonest with you. I honestly don't know. And I'm willing to err on the side of ignorance because it is very difficult to follow the budgetary process. It's very confusing. It's honestly very confusing. And I watched hours of this tape, just hours of it. I did it on the plane coming back from London. I was just watching hours of this stuff. It is very confusing. So I'm willing to believe that they didn't do this on purpose. But to the credit of the Seattle Times, they said, to be clear, this is a permanent defunding. They said this comes as little solace to the folks who in the business community or the public who want a fully staffed police department. They're the ones who said, I think almost verbatim, they shrunk the department. And so Cuomo now is diving into the issue. Like I said, again, they're not the best. And this is why. They say the Seattle City Council also this week voted to eliminate 80 unfilled positions from the Seattle Police Department and reallocate the money in the city budget. No word of it being permanent, which seems to me to be a very key detail. If this was temporary, I wouldn't complain. I supported the idea, and I supported it with Mike Solon, who's the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. I told him, I'm like, it makes sense to me that you would temporarily cut funding for these positions when you know you're not going to fill them and you can use the money elsewhere. Temporary. They don't include that here. But they are talking to the people that matter, the people who actually push back. Sarah Nelson, who was on the show yesterday, Seattle City Councilwoman, she spoke with Cuomo.
This is my constituents' top concern. I share your frustration that the city is not doing more. It's a policy choice to take those off the books permanently, and I think that was a wrong choice.
Permanently. Alex Peterson, another council member, he said, look, I recognize the issues here are being caused, the crime issues, and what you guys are experiencing is a result of the defund movement.
It's no longer theoretical what happens when hundreds of officers leave a police department. We now see the reality of.
Has anyone outside of those two actually said that? Have you heard Lisa Herbold, for example, not to get too in the weeds, which we can unintentionally, so I don't want to, but have you heard the council members who supported the defunding? Have you heard them actually say defunding the police led to this? Some of them are acknowledging that there's an increase in crime. Awesome. Thank you. But you'll recall that when folks early on in this recognized there was an increase in crime, they were claiming it was COVID related. Well, you know, COVID caused all of it. Really? I mean, I didn't murder anyone. Sure, I stole a few cars during COVID pandemic, but I didn't murder anyone. How is that related to COVID? Doesn't make any sense.
Masked bandit.
It made it easier, I suppose. But I mean, it just didn't really make any sense. But I haven't heard anyone acknowledge that their direct actions led to this. They just simply don't say anything. It's remarkable. And, you know, things are so bad here that you've got businesses saying, yeah, we're going to have to hire security because we cannot count on the police. Now, in the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with the owner of Serafina, which is a beloved Italian restaurant in Seattle. It's actually a few blocks away from the studio. They suffered their 18th break-in since, as he says, since the pandemic started. But as I say, since the light on crime policies have been passed, since the defund movement, 18. The first 29 years of his business, he recalls only about 5 break-ins. But in the last two and a half years, 18. And they stole a lot of booze. And I've got the video online over at facebook.com/JasonRantsShow if you want to see the surveillance. These dudes look like they knew what they were doing. Like they look like because you saw the video with me. They're like looking at the actual wine bottles. Like, oh, well, this is a 2022. I don't want that. That's too fresh. Ooh, this is a 1997. Like stuff like it was really odd to me. But they stole somewhere between 30 and 40 bottles of wine. That's thousands of dollars worth of product. Things are getting bad. And it just seems like it's the wrong time to permanently defund. But what do I know? I'm just someone who has a working pair of brain cells. Push the button.
What's trending? The coronavirus.
So the Navy lowered its admission standards because they have a shrinking force. We know that there's a severe recruitment problem within the Navy, within the military in general. And in this case, it means entrance scores that fall into the lowest aptitude percentile. No longer will that disqualify you from joining the Navy, because that's what we want. That's what we want in the Navy. We want just a bunch of dum-dums who can't pass a test. But, you know, kudos to them for wanting to serve. I think that's pretty outstanding, even if they're dummies. But it seems odd that you lower the academic standards, but you don't get rid of the COVID vaccine mandate that we know, as a matter of fact, disqualified a whole bunch of people from service. They were kicked out of service and is a disincentive for some people to want to serve. And that's before even getting into all the woke nonsense, because I would argue that the whole we're going to teach you how to use proper pronouns rather than, you know, defend your country probably turns off the exact kind of person who might want to defend the country. This is just a hunch of mine. But you've got this vaccine mandate that doesn't really make sense. Now, Adam Smith, congressman from here in Seattle. And let's talk to him. Let's get him on the show. He's been on before. He's been a friend of the show. But he took the position of, number one, we should not get into a space where we allow people who didn't want to get the vaccine to come back into service. They should not serve again. He also acknowledges maybe the policy doesn't really make sense anymore. And I'm open to having that. I think it was an interview with Politico. I'm open to those conversations, and those conversations are happening. That you're simply open to them and they're just happening rather than we have some action here doesn't make any sense. And Tulsi Gabbard, who serves her country, she was on with Brian Kilmeade this morning on Fox News.
It makes absolutely no sense. And it just points to, frankly, the failure of leadership, both within the DOD and in politicians in Washington, including President Biden. I know people personally, Brian, who have been kicked out of the military, some who've served 10 years, 20 years, 25 years, all because of this mandate that makes no sense and, frankly, is based on a lie that Fauci and others continue to propagate as they have throughout this whole thing, which is these vaccines will prevent you from catching COVID and that it will prevent you from spreading COVID.
Yep.
The fact that this is even a question at this point, whether or not to lift this DOD mandate and that Secretary Austin is opposing it, is just absolute madness. What to speak of the fact that you've got people like Adam Smith saying that, we won't even consider reinstating those who were kicked out under this crazy policy because, well, people have to follow orders. It should be no question that this mandate should be lifted and those who were kicked out under this wrongheaded decision should be reinstated with back pay.
And by the way, the same people who make the argument about, well, they should follow orders. If you were given a scenario in which soldiers said no to orders that were patently cruel and unconstitutional, just illegal, go slaughter all those innocent people. And they said no, you said, well, I mean, they were right to make the decision, but they weren't following orders, and we can't allow that in the military. They would never hold that position. And yet they're defending this on a policy that does not make any sense, makes no sense whatsoever. 1-800-465-8770. The IRS continues to be aggressive by increasing the number of officers in Washington state. Do not try to take on the IRS yourself. If you owe money to the IRS, contact our local tax expert and advocate, Greg Nunn at Nunn Better Tax Resolution. He will help. N-U-N-N, Nunn Better Tax Resolution. When we come back, we're going to dive into the big local. This hour brought to you by 3010weightlossforlife.com.
Tacoma, Bremerton, Bothell.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Ranch Show.
Redmond, Sumner, Kent.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Hey, look at that. 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means it's time for the Big Local, brought to you by Alpine Specialty Services. They're online at alpineclean.com. This is the part of the show where we completely ignore stories coming out of Seattle, and instead, we focus our attention on the communities you live in and care about most. And we start in Bellevue because there was a procession today for Officer Jordan Jackson of the Bellevue PD. He was killed in the line of duty after a vehicle struck his motorcycle last month. The procession started about 11:15 and ended at the Meydenbauer Center. And he was remembered by family and friends and colleagues. And he was remembered by a community that, unfortunately, although understandably to a point, a community that doesn't tell officers that they support them enough. And I say it's understandable in the sense that, look, it's awkward. It's awkward to go up to an officer and say, hey, thanks for doing what you do. I don't know why it's awkward, right? I honestly, I don't know why it's awkward. And I say this not to toot my own horn at all, but people come up to me and say, hey, thank you for covering so-and-so. And I, you know, to me, it's a little bit awkward because I just don't like that. But like, yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. I don't know why we don't do that with cops. I don't know why we don't do that more often. And the officer that I've spoken to, usually in the city we don't talk about in the segment, they say people come up to us all the time. And weirdly, they do to them what some people do to me, which is they'll go up to them. They'll look for both sides, make sure no one's watching and say, hey, I appreciate what you do. Like they do it on the DL because they don't want to be criticized by lunatics around them that somehow would be offended that you might support an officer. But the fact of the matter is, too many of us only show support for officers when there is a tragedy like this or someone who's seriously injured. People come together. Now, part of me also says, well, they're always there. And they're coming together when the community needs them to come together the most. I just wish we would do a little bit more of this, because this was a guy who, by all accounts, was a tremendous person. And it always feels like when we talk about these kinds of stories, it's always the person who is an exemplary member of whatever agency they're with. This is a guy who decided to help a woman named Louise, who had a breakdown of her car on the highway. The officer wasn't on duty. He didn't have to help. And yet that's exactly what he did, she tells King 5.
It's hard to believe he's actually gone. He was just such a young, vibrant human being. And he, you know, he makes a difference.
He made a difference. Bill, her husband, said this was just a small thing in the grand scheme of things, I guess, but it made such an impression on us.
He just made us feel at ease. It felt to me, and I think it felt like this to my wife and daughter, is that he was really going a bit above and beyond what was called of his duty.
Small interaction like that, acts of kindness, they make a lasting impression.
Now, one of his colleagues, Sergeant Rob Peasy, spoke today. And he remembers his colleague as someone who was always willing to help, always willing to offer an ear just to hear some of your issues.
His bright light will never fade, and he will never be far from us, because he will be held so strongly in our hearts.
I said Rob. Obviously, it's Robin. My apologies. This is a community that's coming together, finally. I just hope that this is a reminder for folks to maybe step up before a tragedy. Jackson leaves behind a wife and two young children, and they're going to need the support, and I have no doubt that they'll get the support. I just want to make sure that we're supporting officers before we unfortunately have to see one of these cases again, because here's the reality. It's not going to happen every day, thank God. But another officer is going to be killed in the line of duty. That is the job that they sign up for. They understand that that is a possibility. We don't get a lot of those cases here in Washington, but we do get some. And so let us not, after the inevitable next incident, which I pray doesn't happen, but my brain says it's going to at some point, let's just make sure that we're getting together and showing support of our officers, whether they're in Bellevue or Everett, whether they're with the Pierce County Sheriff's Department, or whether they're in Spokane, wherever it is they are. Make sure we're just stepping up and saying to them thank you for what it is they do. Meanwhile, also in Bellevue, Sound Transit might start part of the East Side project that's been delayed because Sound Transit's involved, so anything that they touch is always over budget and always, always, always late. Although sometimes then they come back and say, actually, we revised the schedule, so now it's not late. But it was late until you revised it. Well, yes, but then we revised the schedule so that it would be due next month. But it was originally due 4 years ago. Yeah, but we've revised it. When'd you revise it? When we missed the last deadline. Oh, okay, got it. But a little bit of this project is complete. Claudia Balducci, King County Council member, she went on her first ride on the light rail track from Bell Red Station at 130th Street to Overlake Village Station in Redmond. She did it last week. And now she's all like, this is amazing. And we should use this as a starter line. We should just get this up and running. Because it's there, why waste it? Maybe some people will actually use it. She said, I'm even more excited at the prospect of opening an EastLink starter line connecting Redmond to Bellevue ahead of opening the now delayed EastLink connection. You're more excited? It's weird. Wouldn't you be more excited for the whole thing to be done? I'm more excited for a starter line than I am for the entire project. Maybe it's because she knows the entire project is probably never gonna happen. Since I wrote a Seattle, now she's going to pat herself on the back. Since I wrote a Seattle Times op-ed in August urging Sound Transit to explore this Eastside only starter line, the concept has gained momentum with support from Eastside elected and business leaders and the public at large. That last part is not, that's not true. Have you ever heard any, you live in Redmond, have you ever heard anyone say, hey, I like this idea of a starter line to go 2 miles?
No.
I don't know. There's all the public's. The public doesn't even know about this. I'm not saying the public might not get behind it, but the public has no clue about this idea, this concept of a starter line. And I'm willing to bet none of the businesses have thought about it either. No offense to her. And again, I'm not saying if they knew about it as a concept, they wouldn't be supportive. I just question, even though I understand what she's doing, the claim. I think what she's doing is trying to pretend that there's momentum to create momentum, which strategically is probably a smart move. You claim something exists, which gets people excited to then feed into the claim, which only then supports your position. I have a problem, though. Just one tiny problem. One itsy-bitsy problem. Like I said, it's only 2 miles. Okay? If you're in the sort of the market for this kind of transportation mode, you're likely already taking the bus. That's my guess, right? Or you're walking. Like, the people who are most excited, especially a line like this, because, again, you're not. It's not like you're going to multiple stops. There's just one stop. My guess is you're already on the bus. Why would you not just continue to take the bus? Because my guess is it's cheaper. The bus is still going to run the same route, and you're still going to get from point A to point B. But now you're taking on the cost of operating the starter line, not really knowing what the demand is, demand that's already being met. It would be different if you had the full line, or at least multiple stops. But for one stop, to me, just doesn't quite make sense. I'd like to see, and again, it's not like I'm opposed to it on principle, but I would like to see what the finances are. And hopefully Claudia Balducci will come on the show and answer some questions. Because I asked this sincerely. How much would it cost to operate this thing? Right? Presumably it'll be running 12 hours a day, 14 hours. I don't know what they would do for a starter line, but let's just say 12 hours a day. So that's going to be 2, maybe 3 staff members who are drivers, right? Monday through Friday, and then we... So let's just call it 4, just for the sake of argument. Well, what does that cost? Like, what is the cost with also fixing anything that goes wrong? Like, clearing the... Because you're going to potentially do this during winter, when it's possible it gets rainy and leaves end up getting stuck in the tracks, which happens in the city we don't talk about. So what is the cost of them? And how many people do you actually think are going to take it? Like, would you take it? Would you have any reason to?
No. I figure this is to appease Microsoft people. I mean, that's over in that area.
They're not even going back into the office.
I mean, yeah. That's the only thing I can think of why there would be any kind of overwhelming interest for this.
And by the way, if it is for those folks, why doesn't Microsoft pay for a little bit of it? Chip in. I mean, as I recall, and I don't remember this specifically, but I recall Amazon did a little bit of that in the city we don't talk about for their light rail, at least for a portion of it. And I don't remember how much, and I don't know if it was a meaningful amount, but I think it was something. And so maybe Microsoft should chip in just a little bit, because I do think it is valid to raise the question of the cost. And then finally, there was an event in Yakima where owners would bring in their dogs and take photos with the Grinch. If you want to see what a dog looks like that's absolutely terrified and wondering what in God's name it's doing with this green creature known for mistreating its animal, I ask that you just click on, it's on Pima TV's website. Kima's TV's K-I-M-A. Website. You just go look at some of them. Are you looking at it now?
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No, and there's some weird-looking dogs on there, too.
It's not that they're weird-looking, per se.
No,
it's that they're terrified. Some of them are weird-looking, fine. But, I mean, the look of terror on their face.
There's, like, 4 pictures.
They're so scared. And I don't know what the dog... It's, like, the second one with the wiry dogs, the 2 of them in the one photo. I don't know what kind of dogs those are. They look terrified.
Their eyes say, help me.
They're like, why are you doing this to me, Mom? Why am I taking a photo? It's a green monster. And of all the, like, if you're going to do a stupid photo like this, go with Santa. Right? Grinch literally abused the dog. And I don't remember how it ended. I think they made up. But the dog suffered an awful lot of abuse for years and years and years before the Grinch finally, due to a heart condition, decided it was going to be nice and died the next day from an enlarged heart anyway. So the dog didn't even get that much out of it. Just abuse, a lifetime of abuse, and 10 minutes worth of being treated well by the Grinch. Which, in fairness to dogs, that's why we love them so much. Dog was afterwards, it was very grateful that even for 10 minutes, it got some love. This photo is terrifying to these poor dogs. What is the website? It's PimaTV.com?
Kima.
Kima. Why do I keep saying
like
Pima?
Like Yakima without the Y-A.
There you go. Kima. Yakima. Maybe it's Kima then.
Could be.
If it's like Yakima.
I don't know. Quality news coverage, I guess.
It's a horrible news outlet, and the station's website is awful, but the photos there are great. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send a text. We got some numbers coming in. It's getting tight between Warnock and Walker. We'll get you those results when we come back on the Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. We've got a runoff happening right now in Georgia. The votes are being counted. The polls closed at 4 o'clock. This was after 3 weeks of voting, early voting. And things are starting to tighten a little bit. There's only 33% in the vote, 35% of the vote now. Warnock is up 56% to 44% over Herschel Walker. But there are not enough counties to get even Fulton County, which has not fully come in yet. That's where Atlanta is based. We don't have too many numbers coming in. However, there's good news and bad news for both candidates at this point. It's still, and most people, again, you go into this thinking Warnock has a slight edge because he had the slight edge over Herschel Walker during the general. They just didn't get to the 50%. No one got to a 50% margin, so they did the runoff. But what's curious here is comparing how each candidate did in the general to where they are right now. And obviously, again, the caveat is more numbers are starting to come in and it's going to change a little bit. But the Brantley County tracking is about the same for Walker as it was in the general, where in the general he won it by 83%. Now he's at 82%. Now that could go up to 83%, but he's going to want to at least match or presumably, I mean, he wants to exceed where he was during the general. So he's down by about 1% there, but that's still generally considered really good. Then you go into rural county, Washington County in Georgia. That was one of the two that Warnock carried in 2021, but Herschel Walker carried in November. So Walker carried this county, Washington County, by 1.4% in November. Right now, he's doing better at 2.1%. So almost a full percentage point. Now, does that represent a ton of votes? No. However, when you only lost by about a percentage point, all this actually matters. Now, in Brantley County, the margin Walker carried it by in November was 82%. Right now, he's at 83%. So again, that's a nice little result if it holds. For Warnock, if you look at Pierce County, again, super red. I wish our Pierce County was super red, but unfortunately it's getting purple. Thanks, Tacoma. Thanks, Lakewood. But Pierce County, they say Walker carried it by 77.4% in November, and he wins today by 77%. So that's a shortage by almost a half a percentage point, and that all that means is that's a pickup. Presumably, that's a pickup for for Raphael Warnock. More good news for Warnock. This, according to Dave Wasserman over at the Cook Political Report, Ben Hill County, Walker carried it by 28.9% in November. Right now, he's winning it by 27.5%. So that is a loss of votes. Again, we got to look at the grand scheme of things and how many votes are total cast. But that's not good for Herschel Walker. In Warren County, which is the first majority black county that has been completed in its voting, Warnock wins it by 5.1%. That's the same exact margin as he did in November. They say turnout is 95% of November votes cast, which is about the same as complete super red counties, he writes. He says this is going to be a close runoff result, perhaps closer than the Warnock plus three polling consensus. But you'd still much rather be Warnock than Walker right now. And again, that's about where we thought things were going to be. They will tighten a little bit. But, you know, again, Warnock has the edge. Whether or not he can hold on to it is, what did we say? What was the lazy analysis I provided?
Whoever gets the most votes wins.
Yeah. And in this case, this is what we mean when we talk about turnout matters, because you can compare it. It's harder to make an honest comparison when you've got 4 years separating with different candidates, different issues, to say, well, 4 years ago in King County, it was at 61%, but this time it's 59%. Well, is it fair to compare it to 4 years ago? I would argue not, unless you've got the exact same candidates and, generally speaking, the same economic conditions, the same issues that are important to voters. in this case, when you do 1% better in the general than you do in the runoff, that hurts. That really hurts you. And so if that 1% represents 6,000 votes in one county and maybe 10,000 votes in another and 30,000 votes in another, that adds up very, very quickly. And that's how you lose these kinds of elections. And this is why you saw such a significant push to get out the vote. You had all of a lot of the big names within the Republican movement, particularly in the South, showing up and trying to generate excitement and get people out there. It's in particular why Herschel Walker was spending the last moments of the campaign, including, I believe, today in rural counties of Georgia, where you got to do a little bit more to make sure they vote, because it doesn't matter that these are smaller counties as far as the population. That's where you're going to pick up a lot of the votes. And you have to hope from the perspective of you know, what you know you're going to lose in Atlanta, but what you want to do is make sure that the loss is not as wide as it was during the general. And there's no doubt about it. Fulton County, which is, again, where Atlanta is, and whatever county, Savannah, Georgia's in, those are going to go for Warnock. He won huge in those counties in the general. Can you make up some of the votes by having some of those people stay home and not vote? Yeah. And that's why even a half a percentage really does matter. So as of right now, it's 55% to 45%, give or take, because I'm rounding up and rounding down depending on the numbers. So we'll see where things go. Franklin County numbers are coming in. Walker was at 71.3% in November. He's now at 73.1% tonight. And that is a really strong result. And that's where and right now things are starting to tighten even as I'm speaking, because I'm looking at the election ticker. Things are starting to tighten. They will continue to tighten throughout the night. Now, do I expect that we'll have a winner? If the current results trend in this direction and continue to tighten, we're not going to have a winner tonight. We'll probably have a winner tomorrow. But I haven't seen. Have you seen any numbers on the total turnout I haven't seen any of that yet. Don't give me a look like you looked. You just pretend you weren't looking. Why'd you just pretend like you were looking?
I answered the question.
Now, in fairness, I asked that question knowing you were not looking for any of that. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text.